Chimpanzees making and hunting with spears, males vying for alpha status, and adolescents causing trouble. It was an eventful summer for the Fongoli Savannah Chimpanzee Project. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Jill Preetz is the director of the Fongoli Savannah Chimpanzee Project in southeastern Senegal and a professor of anthropology at Iowa State University. She's just returned from her summer in Senegal. We'll talk about her most recent observations and the group of chimpanzees she studies. Later in the hour, an update from the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines, formerly known as the Great Ape Trust. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, great apes. Later in the hour, an update on the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines, formerly known as the Great Ape Trust and the five bonobos that live there. But we're going to start the hour with chimpanzees. Jill Preetz is the director of the Fongoli Savannah Chimpanzee Project in southeastern Senegal. She is also the Walvoord Professor of Liberal Arts and Sciences, specializing in biological anthropology at Iowa State University. And she's just returned from her summer in Senegal. She's here with us today. Hello, Jill.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Oh, thanks for asking me. You know, I love to talk about chimps.
Well, I think a lot of people have heard about your work with the chimpanzees in Senegal, but we'll remind people about this group of chimpanzees a little bit before we talk about your most recent observations. These are savanna chimps, so they're a little bit different than the chimps that most of us associate with this kind of research, right?
Right. Almost all of the chimp studies have been done on chimps that live in forested habitats, and I think a lot of people think that's the only place chimps live. There are quite a few that live in these savannas, and so it's very open. Grass is the dominant vegetation, and they're still chimps. They're surprisingly chimp-like in many ways, but all of the really interesting findings from the site can be tied back into this very different habitat. It's very hot and dry, and I always say it's not a very chimpy habitat, but, you know, they do well, a lot better than me, I think.
Well, and the observation that you've made at this site that has gotten the most attention around the world is observing chimpanzees making spears and actually hunting with the spears, passing this skill along to younger chimpanzees as well. And what kinds of animals do they hunt with the spears?
Well, they hunt these, actually, I have to say, they're quite adorable little primates, prosimian primates called bush babies. And the bush babies are pretty small, about the size of a guinea pig or so, but with a long tail. And they're nocturnal, so they live in, they sleep in cavities, tree cavities during the day, and that's when the chimps target them. And so they make these spear-like tools, and they jab down into the cavity to get, again, this little bush baby. But I will say that it's over very quickly. Actually, this past summer, I saw the most hunts that I'd seen ever at the field site. So I'm adding those to the database, and we're hoping to get a new paper published on that pretty quickly.
Wow. Well, when you first proposed studying these chimpanzees, a lot of people had doubts about your ability to actually observe them because of the environment, right?
Right. There had been one effort in the 1970s to habituate chimpanzees, actually in Senegal as well. And that's usually the way primatologists operate, is you basically get the subjects used to you so that you can follow them around. And ideally, they would ignore you. They don't always do that. But savanna chimpanzees had not been habituated. And so, yeah, I had, you know, reviewers of proposals say why I thought I could do this when no one else could. I knew I could, but, you know, I don't know if you could say I just persevered or if I was stubborn, but, you know, it took us 4 years, but we were successful. And I think there's a couple of other savanna chimp sites that are close to habituating, those subjects as well. And so, you know, I have to credit Iowa State, of course, and other granting agencies for taking a chance. And I think it paid off.
When you say habituate, what exactly does that mean?
Well, habituation is interesting, and ideally, you'd like the animals to completely ignore you. And that's not the case. We know that we affect their behavior to some degree, but you want to affect their behavior as little as possible. So with savanna chimps, the problem was that usually when they see you, they're afraid and they flee. In forests, they may go up in trees, but in a savanna, they just go away. And then you're not likely to encounter the same individuals often like you would in a forested area where chimps have much smaller home ranges. So it took us 4 years of contact to finally get them to the point where they accepted us. They let us follow them. So we follow them from when they get up in the morning to when they go to bed at night. And for the most part, they ignore us. I always say they don't read my protocol, so they don't always ignore us. But you want to try to affect them as little as possible. And habituation allows you to get, you know, the type of data that you just can't get with other indirect methods, although we do use things like camera traps as well in certain situations. We don't radio track chimpanzees. It was a long process, but I actually thought it would take longer than 4 years. So I was pretty happy about that.
So I can imagine when observing chimpanzees in the forest, it's just a lot easier to make yourself scarce. And so when you're out there on the savanna and they can't help but see what you're doing, and I'm sure they observe you, maybe not quite as much as you observe them, but how close can you actually get to them without really starting to interfere with their behavior?
And, you know, it really depends on the chimp. Some chimps are so well habituated, you could probably be within a meter or two of them. And in fact, some of them, Mike, for example, Mike's a favorite. He's a young male, but he basically grew up with us. So, you know, we've always been part of his life. He'll come within a couple of meters. I have a really conservative protocol, though, for various reasons. I don't want to be that close to the chimps. Primarily because we can transmit diseases to them. So I try to stay 10 meters from chimps. But, you know, Mike, especially the males, some of the males are very relaxed around us and they'll come quite close. Juveniles and older infants tend to want to play with researchers, and so you have to move away from them. This summer I had an interesting experience where an old female Nene, who is, she can't see very well anymore and she's hard of hearing, I guess she thought I was a chimp, and she starts coming to greet me. And since she's old, she's very exuberant in her greeting. She's very submissive. And so she started rushing towards me to greet me, which is basically making a loud vocalization. And I stood up and, or well, I first hooted at her to try to indicate that, hey, I'm not a chimp. You can stop. But I don't know if she mistook my hoot for a chimp because she just kept coming faster. And so then I finally had to get up and move away. And I was on a really steep hill is why I didn't move away in the first place. And then I finally turned around and she had turned around and gone back with her daughter. But I thought that she would be shocked when she got up to actually touch me and found out I was a human. But so it just depends. But it's something that we have to be careful of. And I do wear surgical masks when we're closer than 10 meters to the chimps, again, because of the possibility of disease transmission. But we don't want them to get over habituated to where they're so comfortable that they completely lose fear of humans. So right now they're habituated to us, but not to humans in general. And so that's the way we want to keep it.
When you say us, how many people are you talking about?
Well, I purposely have a small team because of the fact that I don't want them to become habituated to humans in general because they live around people. And Senegal is somewhat unique in that people don't hunt chimpanzees. They don't eat chimps. But
now I know that we'll get back to my question that
sure.
I just asked before. But that is so interesting to me because, I mean, that's a huge problem for chimp populations, the hunting, the human pressures. But what makes things different in Senegal?
Well, when I first arrived there, I was intending to work in the national park, and I did a survey outside the park, and I saw chimps. I didn't see chimps very often the first year I was there. But when I saw them, I was surprised at, you know, they fled, but they were actually calmer than the chimpanzees in the park who rarely see people. It's not a national park where you have a lot of tourists like in East Africa or South Africa. And I, you know, talked with people there in Senegal, and I learned that there are, in fact, taboos against eating chimpanzees. And so that's why chimpanzees still remain in the area when a lot of the large mammals have been exterminated outside of the park, like elephants and lions in many places, not all places. And so I actually had a student from another university come and do her master's thesis project. She's a cultural anthropologist, and she interviewed people about what she called folklore. And they had origin myths that explained chimpanzees as basically coming from humans that had done something wrong. And so in one case, there were young men who many of the groups, cultural groups in Senegal, the young men go through circumcision ceremonies when they're teenagers. And so you can imagine that would be a daunting type of event. And in this one particular tale, and I always apologize because if it was one of my friends in Senegal, they would tell this very elaborate, eloquent story, and I tell it, you know, in a few sentences. But at any rate, these young men were afraid to go through the circumcision ceremony, so they ran off into the woods, and over time they became chimpanzees. And in another case, another group, cultural group, has their origin myth for chimpanzees stems from people who were fishing on Friday. So Friday was a day of rest, and these men that had gone fishing on Friday eventually turned into chimpanzees. So because of these cultural taboos, chimps are protected in Senegal. And so I found that, as an anthropologist, incredibly interesting. So even before the chimps were habituated, you know, there were a number of really interesting questions that we could explore.
Absolutely. Now let's get back to my question about your team. How many people are involved?
Right. Well, it is a small team. And I have three Senegalese men that work for me that actually observe the chimps. I have one main research assistant, Michel, and he is wonderful. He knows the chimps better than anybody, including myself. And he basically, you know, is there all the time, and he does get some days off a week. And so that's when I have one of the other two employees take over for him. But so one of my employees, my project manager, in fact, has been working for me since 2001. And then Michelle has been working for me since 2008, I believe. And then I just took on a new employee. And I've been really lucky. You know, I can't say enough good things about the people that work for me. Michelle, for example, will tell me when I'm there, he probably doesn't like it as much because I go out with the chimps by myself. And he gets some days off, but also I have other things for him to do. And he tells me that, in fact, if he's not with the chimps for a few days, he'll start dreaming about them. So,
really?
Yeah, he's really attached. It's really interesting to compare, you know, notes with him and that sort of thing. So I do have a small team. But like I said, the chimps know us, and they're still afraid of other people.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Jill Preetz. She's the director of the Fongole Savanna Chimpanzee Project in southeastern Senegal. She's also the Walvoord Professor of Liberal Arts and Sciences, specializing in biological anthropology at Iowa State University. You can see some pictures of the chimpanzees we're talking about if you go to our website, iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about great apes. We're talking about chimpanzees at the moment. We'll turn to bonobos in just a few minutes and get an update on what is now known as the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines. With me right now is Jill Preetz. She's the director of the Fongole Savanna Chimpanzee Project in southeastern Senegal. She's also the Walvoord Professor of Liberal Arts and Sciences, specializing in biological anthropology at Iowa State University. And Jill, let's talk about some of the things that you saw this summer. You've mentioned the names of a couple of the different chimpanzees. How large a group of chimpanzees are you following?
Right now, we're at about 31 individuals, although when I left, we're all sure that Ava's going to have an infant before the end of the year. So I keep waiting for that news, but I haven't quite heard it yet.
And that's a big deal because there weren't any babies last year?
Last year was one of the first years where there were no babies. There were quite a few babies the year before. And, you know, chimps have infants about every 4 years. And so we had a slow year last year.
So waiting for maybe a small baby boom to come. And you spend most of your time watching the males, right?
I do watch the males. I had heard when I started my project that even though people don't eat chimps, that every once in a while you have someone target a chimp for the pet trade. And so I wanted to be just sort of, you know, maybe some people say overcautious. I don't think so, but I do follow only the males. And the females, while they're habituated, they're relaxed when they're in a group with males, they're not used to being followed. And so, for example, when I encounter females outside of the big social group of males, they're nervous, and that's the way I want them to stay. And so I'm really interested in female behavior. And in fact, females do most of the hunting with tools, but I observe them opportunistically. So yeah, I follow one male from day to day. I choose one male as subject, and I try to follow him all day if I can.
All right. And you made that decision because you don't want to habituate the females and make them vulnerable to people who might want to steal their infants. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Exactly. And so the chimps definitely, and other primates and other animals, I'm sure they know when they're being followed, and females are not comfortable being targeted like that. And so they're just a little less habituated than males. And so that's, yeah, exactly why I want it like that.
So what are some of the male behaviors that your research has focused on?
Well, we have definitely focused on hunting and sharing. And so we have interesting patterns of food sharing at Fongoli, where we call it sharing, but actually it's sometimes it seems like it's food taking or food stealing. But males actually allow females to take foods from them, and foods that aren't normally shared by chimpanzees, like fruits. So chimps at every site they've been studied share meat, and they definitely share meat at Fongoli. So that's one of the things we're focusing on right now. But males also share fruits and other types of foods with females. And so it's interesting to see this pattern of male tolerance, but it's also interesting to see this pattern of female assertiveness at Fongoli. So that's a little bit different. That's one of the areas that we're focusing on right now. And right now at Fongoli, there's quite sort of a shakeup in the dominance hierarchy. So that's something that we're keeping our eye on, as a sort of a little clique of young males have matured. They've, basically shaken things up. And so that's something we're focusing on right now also.
And who is the alpha male?
David is the alpha. He's been alpha for a couple of years.
All right. And so he's still the alpha male, but you've been watching closely his brother.
Yes. David's brother, Mamadou, we've known since the project started. He was, in fact, the second male to be given a name, and he's always been quite brave. He's almost always held the second position. He's never made it to alpha. He's almost always held the second position, no matter who's been the alpha. And in fact, he helped David attain the alpha status. David is younger than Mamadou. When I returned in May, I'd heard that they hadn't seen Mamadou for about, since February. And this is pretty rare, but sometimes it does happen. The chimps at Fongoli are also more cohesive than chimps elsewhere, where you have a lot more fission-fusion dynamics to the social group. And what we think is going on is that Mamadou has been pushed out of the major social group by this clique of young males, so four young males. And partly because of the support he gives David. Mamadou can be somewhat of a bully, but his bark is worse than his bite. He does these amazing displays. He's one of the few chimps that will actually jump into water and splash around during a display. And we're pretty sure that he's on the fringes of things right now. And once Mamadou was ousted, there was a concerted attack on David. And David left, I guess, to nurse his wounds, which fortunately were minor, for about a day. And then he came back. And David's behavior has changed significantly. So he's been cultivating relationships with some of the older males. So it's pretty, you know, I always say, and anybody that studies primates will tell you, it's like a soap opera, and it really is this year.
Yeah, it sounds so Machiavellian to try to isolate, and I know anthropomorphic, but to isolate the alpha from his chief supporter.
Right. And I mean, it's chimps, it's definitely been the case not only in wild chimps, but in captive chimps. There's been well-documented cases where, chimps can't, young males can rise only so far in the hierarchy based on, you know, their brute strength, et cetera. They really need allies. And so Mamadou is key to David. So we're, you know, those of us who are fans of David as alpha, even though, you know, we're as scientifically objective as possible, we still admit, our biases as far as alpha males go. We're a little nervous about David's status, but, you know, he's holding on to it for now.
You also, there's a young male that's been causing a little bit of trouble. Tell me about Psy.
Oh, Psy, yes.
Named because he's a cyclone.
Named, yes, after Psy for cyclones, and he is a cyclone. He's living up to his name. So Psy is almost five, and so he's in the process of being weaned, which is a very difficult time for him and a difficult time for everyone, including researchers. And so Psy will do things like run straight towards a researcher because he knows it will bring his mother running to, you know, embrace him and so he can perhaps nurse. And he's just getting beyond that. So thank goodness.
So he's using you as a tool.
Yes, exactly. And he is very well habituated. Again, he definitely grew up with us. And so he's not afraid of us. And infants are very sheltered and they don't really have things to be anything to be afraid of. Their mother always protects them. And then once they get to be juveniles and they have to be independent, and then they start being a little more cautious. But he's still in that stage where he's not cautious whatsoever. And so he'll do things like run up as close as he can to you and, you know, somersault off. He did that to me several times this summer. And he does it to the adult males, too.
How big is he?
He's pretty small. Oh, gosh. He's not, you know, he's 20 some odd pounds probably or so. You know, he's not a big chimp. But he's you know, chimps are very strong. And I'm not at all worried about Psy. But if you make his mother mad, that could be a little worrisome. And she's a very high ranking female. She's an incredibly popular female with the males when she's an estrus. So she's got the backing of the adult males. So you don't really want to make mom mad or the adult males. We had the BBC out filming this summer, and at one point I looked over through my binoculars and there was Psy on some backpacks, and I had to literally run over there and chase him away from the BBC guys, who were a little shocked, and didn't quite know what to do. And so, yeah, Psy was quite the troublemaker this summer. We're all a little afraid of Psy as an adolescent, so we hope he calms down a little bit.
Teenager.
Yes.
Could be dangerous. All right. And you mentioned the BBC. We will have a chance to see the Fungoli chimps on the BBC coming up fairly soon, right?
Yes. From what I understand, in October, at least in the UK, it's part of a series called Life Story. And especially one chimp, Dawson, is the focus. And Dawson is a late adolescent. He's just growing up. And so there's some amazing footage of Dawson as well as the other chimps in the community. So I'm not sure when it will air here, but hopefully this year.
When a camera crew comes in like that, is that disruptive to your research?
It's disruptive to a certain degree, it would be impossible if I wasn't there. So I don't allow any crews to be there when I'm not there. But they definitely, all the camera crews that have visited have been really willing to work with me. Basically, I have a lot of rules that they have to follow. I'm very protective. But for example, they have to be led by Michelle, my head research assistant. And so he's always the one that sets up shots for them, because he knows the chimps, and the various chimps differ in how close you can get. So even keeping to our 10-meter minimum, some females, for example, like Natasha, just doesn't really like it when you have a camera pointed at her, even though thankfully now the cameras are much smaller. And so, we have a number of different guidelines, but I'm not sure what happened with Psy this summer. But, I think everybody was frightened of me coming in and trying to get things back in order, humans and chimps alike. But, it can be, but it rarely is. And so also, you know, they're only there for a very brief time, 3 or 4 weeks, usually per year maximum. And I only have one team a year that I allow to come. So
you also spent time at another site in Senegal this summer. Why was that?
Yes, I spent some time at a site that's about 25 kilometers from Fongoli. It's on the edge of the Niakolo-Koba National Park, and it's a really amazing place. It's it's a little hillier. We would call them hills. They're called mountains there. It's because there's going to be a corporate gold mine established. And so I work as a consultant for the environmental company that consults for the gold mine. and the mining company. And so we were doing chimpanzee surveys there. It was a very extensive 5-week project, and I spent probably just about a third of my time there. But it was, you know, we found some amazing places in the national park, which is right at the edge of this mining concession. And Senegal, mining is a big threat to the chimpanzee population. So we're making a concerted effort, all of the primatologists that work in Senegal. And there's quite, there's a handful of us now to work with the mining companies. And, you know, it's going to happen. And so we really have to be proactive in how we, how things unfold. And so that's what I was doing part of the time.
Now, of course, here in the United States, we've been hearing a lot of news about Ebola in Africa, not Ebola in Senegal, but Ebola in Africa. And that's also a disease that can affect chimpanzees. Is that something that you're worried about?
You know, I personally haven't been so worried about it, but then I don't, I'm not a big worrier in terms of those types of things. It is actually not that far from Senegal, and Senegal has once again closed their borders with Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, I believe, and they've been criticized for it. So far, you know, knock on wood, there haven't been any cases in Senegal, but you have a lot of people from Guinea that are involved in artisanal gold mining in Senegal and other countries as well. And so you could easily have, you know, cases occur in Senegal. I've been thinking more about it. I still plan on going to Senegal, hopefully before the beginning of October, but it definitely could, you know, be a, if it did get to Senegal, just like the other countries in West Africa, it would be difficult to deal with. Medical care there is, at least where I work in the rural areas, is I think it would be difficult to deal with Ebola cases. And then you could have chimpanzees infected, definitely. There's a number of chimpanzees and gorillas who had died of Ebola virus in Gabon some years ago when there was an outbreak there.
You have also extended your work to another kind of ape that lives in Senegal, of course, human beings, by founding a nonprofit called Neighbor Ape. What are your goals with that?
Neighbor Ape... we've got various small goals. One of the bigger goals that we have right now is to hopefully build a dispensary in one of the villages that borders the chimpanzee area. Most of our goals are pretty small scale for the moment, so we try to fund a number of students every year. We usually fund at least 6 school children of various ages, and we put a woman through nursing school in Dakar, so that was I think one of our best accomplishments so far. We just finished building, with the aid of some very generous donors, a dormitory in the regional town of Kédougou so that village children can actually live in Kédougou and go to schools there. And the schools are better than in the rural areas where it's difficult for teachers sometimes even to get there. There are a lot of missed days of school and that sort of thing. And so, and we do other things like distribute mosquito nets. And then we have conservation programs. We have a series of workshops. So there are a number of various little small projects. I think the dormitory project was a big one. And now I think we're going to move to focus on this dispensary at the village of Gingy, which is the chimps range right next to this village.
Now, this summer, not only you traveled to Senegal, but you also traveled to Costa Rica and taught a course for Iowa State University on primatology. Is primatology beginning to be a draw for students to Iowa State University? This is not something that the school's been known for in the past, although clearly you've made a name for yourself working at Iowa State. Are there a lot more students coming to Iowa State because they're interested in that or at least turning in that direction?
Well, I, you know, I'm not sure. I've always had a nice group of graduate students apply to work with me. But this is the first time I've had so many undergraduates actually take the Costa Rica course. So oftentimes I'll have probably not more than 10 actual Iowa State students take this course that I teach in Costa Rica. And it's, you know, they do have to pay station fees. Study Abroad has a great program to where their tuition and fees are reduced, but they do have to pay station fees and they have to pay the cost of travel, flights to Costa Rica. So I was really surprised that we had over 15 Iowa State undergraduates apply and take this class in Costa Rica. And there are quite a few that are interested in primatology. I'm not sure if they're interested in field primatology like I do, or with captive primates, zoo situations, that sort of thing. But I was really surprised. And usually I open up my class to students from other universities, and I didn't do that this year because I had so many students. And it's a very intensive course. It was only 3 weeks this year, so it was even more intensive. But yeah, I think they all enjoyed it. I think it was tough and a new experience for some of them, but I surely enjoyed it.
What primates did you focus on in Costa Rica?
Well, in Costa Rica, they're at least in our area, which is not far from the Caribbean, in northeastern Costa Rica, you have spider monkeys and howling monkeys and then capuchins. And spider monkeys are interesting because they're like chimps in their social system. There are very few primates that have a true fission-fusion system like chimpanzees and bonobos. Spider monkeys are one. I tend to focus on spider monkeys when I run across them. The students study howling monkeys. Actually, okay. For beginners, howler monkeys are a little easier.
Jill, we're out of time for today, but I hope you'll come back after your next trip to Senegal coming up at the end of September.
Oh, I definitely will. Thank you.
Okay, wonderful. Jill Preetz is the director of the Fongoli Savannah Chimpanzee Project in southeastern Senegal. She's also the Walvoord Professor of Liberal Arts and Sciences, specializing in biological anthropology at Iowa State University. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to get an update on the bonobos at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and we're turning from chimpanzees to bonobos now. The Great Ape Trust made a lot of news when it came to Des Moines. It was home to superstar bonobo Kanzi and six other bonobos, and an ape language program that's been going on for more than 30 years. The Great Ape Trust continued to make news and stir up controversy. It's also been through a few name changes, and now it's under new leadership with another new name. It's now called the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative. It's home to five bonobos, including Kanzi, of course. And Bill Hopkins is the president and staff scientist there now. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Charity. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being here today.
No trouble.
And Bill, tell me a little bit about your background, because you actually had encountered this research project and these bonobos before, when the project was based in Atlanta, right?
That is correct. I've had a longstanding connection with both an individual connection with a number of the bonobos that we have in Iowa now, dating all the way back to the early 1980s. I moved to Atlanta from Wisconsin and was in graduate school at the Language Research Center, which is part of Georgia State University. At that time, Kanzi and some of the other bonobos were living there, as well as some chimpanzees that had been part of the Language Research Center and the language work. So I was working in that lab and doing my PhD work there at the time. And in fact, Kanzi was two when I started working with them.
All right. And for people who aren't familiar with the history of this project, when Kanzi was two, that was really the age at which this project took off, because at that point, the researcher, Sue Savage Rumba, was trying to teach his adoptive mother, Matata, language or lexigrams, symbols to communicate with, and Kanzi spontaneously started picking them up, and he became the focus of the project.
That's absolutely correct. In fact, you know, we were working one-on-one oftentimes with Matata. Kanzi was with her, and once he began to show some promise, you know, we began to focus a bit on him. And, you know, I just remember talking with Sue one day and saying, you know, I definitely have the impression he understands, you know, the speech that our speech signals, not necessarily just the symbols. And, you know, she was like, wow, that could be really remarkable. And it turned out that his speech comprehension abilities were very advanced even at that age. And, you know, of course, became even more sophisticated as he got older.
Right. And as this project continued, I mean, Kanzi was really the superstar standout bonobo as far as picking up these lexigrams, understanding human speech. His sister, Pambanisha, also had a remarkable vocabulary. But there are also bonobos, and Pambanisha has passed away. There were bonobos also in this group that did not acquire language. So can you describe for me a little bit of the dynamic of the five different bonobos that now are part of the project?
Well, all right. So we have still Kanzi, of course, and he remains, you know, very engaged with his keyboard system and the people working with him. We also have Alikia and Yodo, both of whom have been exposed to the symbols, but not nearly as consistently and as extensively as Kanzi. But all of them have, you know, exposure to the keyboard, but it's really just a matter of how engaged and how each individual scientist or individual care staff member is focusing on their work with them. And then we have Maisha, and he's really, he's also a young male, and he's also, again, been exposed to the symbols, but not worked with too extensively on their use. And then lastly, we have young Tico, and he's been a pretty significant focus of, in essence, the next generation of the symbol work. So we're trying to work with him on a fairly regular basis in terms of, you know, his use of the symbols and documenting his use of the symbols and documenting his other cognitive abilities and his language abilities.
And Matata, the matriarch of this group, she also recently passed away.
That's correct. Yeah, Matata passed away several months ago. She was in her mid to upper 40s. I can't give you an exact age because she was wild-caught, so it's always just an estimation with them. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, she lived a good life, but, you know, it came to an end.
With the new leadership and new direction at this project, what is the focus of the research that you're doing now?
Well, I mean, we're going to continue, and we plan to continue the work that started 30 years ago, and that is the focus on symbol acquisition and use, and what you know is necessary, and what kinds of abilities develop as a consequence of that those particular rearing experiences. So that part really isn't going to change. What we're really trying to do is sort of augment the research program that's there by having essentially a number of projects that spin off and capitalize on the language skills that these apes have. So, you know, one part of our focus is going to be on questions about what does acquiring a language bring, or what are the consequences of that for your other kinds of communication behaviors or cognitive functions. And I'll just give one example. We're really interested in the idea of theory of mind, so the idea that I can think, I can alter my behavior based on what I think your thoughts are. And it turns out that to try to measure something like theory of mind is very, very difficult in a nonverbal organism. But here, you know, at ACCI, I mean, we have these apes that have these communication systems, so we're able to sort of capitalize on the existence of those systems to ask something about how they think and other one of their fellow apes is thinking. So I think it's just a really unique way of asking a question about theory of mind. So that's, to some extent, the kinds of, and essentially, you know, those kinds of questions weren't really first and foremost or central to the research program. So we're trying to expand those kinds of questions. We're also really interested in aspects of genomics. We're also interested in neuropsychology as well. So we're really interested in, for example, the brain. Most people who acquire language, it's dominant in the left half of their brain. So we're really interested in, you know, how is the language system that these apes use, how is that represented in their brain? And similarly, do you get changes in gene expression, potentially gene function, and with these kinds of rearing experiences? So that's, you know, these are all just projects that are kind of building on what the skill sets are for the bonobos at our facility.
And what would actually studying brain function and doing brain scans, what would that involve for the bonobos?
Well, I mean, it could be done several ways. So there, it is a non-invasive procedure, but if you, so there's ways to do electrophysiology, so you can measure recording of electrical activity on the skull, for example. That's one way of making inferences about how the brain is working. You can also do, there's actually some temperature-based ways to measure cortical activity now that can be used pretty easily. Ideally, we would like to get a picture of each of the apes' brains. That would require that they either sit in an MRI machine voluntarily, or that we would try to collect a brain scan from them on an occasion where they would have to be under anesthesia for some other kind of procedure, for example, a survey or a full-scale physical exam or something like that. So, but that would be much more opportunistic. I think our goal
You're not proposing knocking them out to do brain scans.
No, we're not proposing to do that. We're proposing that if they are going to be knocked out, that it would be a good occasion to capture those scans if we can.
Now, one of the interesting things about this group of bonobos is the culture in which they have existed for more than 30 years. And when I spoke to Dr. Sue Savage-Rumbaugh at the facility a couple of years ago, she was very excited about the idea that Tico, the youngest bonobo, was growing up in this bilingual culture, in this bi-species culture, where he was interacting with humans as much as he was interacting with bonobos and the kind of communication that was going on there. Now, these apes had been with Sue Savage-Rumbaugh and with her sister, who was one of the primary caretakers for the bonobos, for more than three decades. They are no longer involved. How has that transition gone for the bonobos?
Well, I mean, by any measure that we have available, I mean, the bonobos are perfectly fine with, you know, the circumstances that they are now. Is that your question?
Have you been able to observe? I mean, I know that when I was visiting the facility, one of the lexicograms was for Sue, and Kanzi would call for her
right
when he wanted to talk to her. Have you been able to observe that there is a behavior that shows that he's missing the people that he spent so many years with?
We don't have any evidence of that. I mean, it's not as if you know, they appear stressed out or anything like that, or that they're using the symbol for Liz or the symbol for Sue at all, really. I mean, we haven't really seen any of that.
There have been a lot of concerns, something that we've seen a lot in the media, concerns about the health of the bonobos, a lot of conversations about Kanzi's weight, for example. And, of course, Matata was elderly when she passed away. Panbanisha was not as old. So there were concerns also about her health and her care. How is the health, the physical health of the bonobos, and what are the challenges that you see there?
I would say the physical health of the bonobos right now is excellent. Kanzi has lost some weight, and so we feel like he looks pretty good right now. I think one thing that people don't really understand about Kanzi is, you know, he is a bonobo, and bonobos are typically smaller than chimps, and typically they're kind of lanky and thin, all right? But Kanzi's father was a male named Bosanjo, and Bosanjo was a big male, and it wasn't because of anything about other than just who he was as an individual. So I think Kanzi, you know, is a bigger bonobo, but I think he comes to that size, you know, for reasons that are more than just, you know, he's not eating healthy. But I would say we've improved the diet. We've tried to limit, you know, the sweets and things like that, or the high caloric or high sugar drinks and things like that. So we've tried to improve the diet, not just for Kanzi, but for all of the apes. And then in addition to that, you know, the health and the well-being of the bonobos are really, myself and Dr. Tagliatella, I mean, this is really our first priority, and it's something that we spend a lot of time thinking about and worrying about in terms of making sure that they have adequate veterinary care and that we're monitoring their health, not reacting when they get ill, but actually trying to put in place, you know, a prevention program or a monitoring program, which I don't really think was the case before. So we're working really hard to, for example, have all of the apes work with really essentially anyone who's working with them, any of the care staff, and to have them reliably be able to present different body parts or to tolerate, you know, a rectal thermometer so we can get an accurate measure of core body temperature, and or we can use tympanic membrane we can measure the heat reflected off the tympanic membrane to collect body temperature. We're also trying to bring in a group of people called the Great Ape Heart Project. It's a group of veterinarians and veterinary technicians. One of the primary causes of death in great apes in captivity is cardiovascular disease. And about three or four years ago, this group got together and started traveling to different places and assisting zoos and research facilities in assessing, you know, cardiovascular function, particularly in the males, at different places. So we're trying to get them to come. We want to make sure that all of our apes are presenting and are able to tolerate, you know, an echocardiogram so we can get a good assessment of their heart functions. So if there's anything we need to do, we can intervene now rather than wait until their health deteriorates.
Now, a lot of the changes at the facility were precipitated by a funding crisis. When the Great Ape Trust was founded in Des Moines, it was privately funded, and that changed. And so there have been a lot of changes. What is your funding situation now?
Our funding situation is challenging. I'll be quite honest about that. Basically, we have some research dollars that we have from some existing grants that are being used to support some of the ongoing science projects right now. We've received some support from our institutions. I'm at Georgia State University. Dr. Tagliatelle is at Kennesaw. They have stepped up and provided some bridge support to our organization. We do get some revenue from some of the tours and public events that we do, but primarily those are the principal sources of funding at this moment. So we have a number of grants that are out now that we're trying to get private sector support or foundation support for the institution. And we're looking, you know, for other places to generate revenue that will help us operate. But, it's a challenge and it takes some time. And so that's what we're working on very hard right now.
And do you see a future in Des Moines?
I do. I hope so. And I really hope that, the citizens of Des Moines and all of Iowa, you know, get behind what we're trying to do. It's a remarkable facility. It really is. It's a state-of-the-art facility. I've been doing primatology for, 30 years now, and it's the best place in the world. And we have the most remarkable animals. And I think, if we can just, I just think we can do some really amazing things there. And I'm going to do everything I possibly can to try to keep the apes there in Des Moines and to develop our facility, not just limp along, but I mean, we really have some big plans for what we want to do going forward and what we think we can do at this facility and in Des Moines.
And you're actually hoping to bring more apes into the facility in the future?
To some extent. So the NIH has made the decision to essentially retire some of the chimpanzees that are currently residing in different facilities around the U.S. So the NIH owns about 450 of them. And so we're very interested in bringing some of those apes to our facility. We have a lot of space. We actually have a vacant building now that could house probably 20 chimpanzees, maybe more. And, we really see that as a great potential resource, not just, in terms of providing revenue for our facility, but also broadening the research program in really significant ways. We would have then at our facility, both bonobos and chimpanzees, which we heard great stories from Jill just a moment ago, in the same facility. And having these two species in the same place where we can do these really, really nice comparative studies looking at how they differ and how they're similar and how that maps on.
It could be very exciting. Bill, we're out of time, but thank you so much for talking with me today.
Okay, you're welcome.
Bill Hopkins is the president and staff scientist at the Ape Cognition and Conservation Initiative in Des Moines. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.